Praise Father, Son, and Holy Ghost.
Hello, my friends. Welcome back to our Through the Bible podcast. This is Josh Swanson, lead pastor at Christ Church in Sierra Madre. So today is an exciting day. We are launching out into the book of Deuteronomy. So, fun fact, the very first words that Jesus speaks in the New Testament. So here we're in Matthew chapter 4. It's the very first red letters. In fact, the first three statements that Jesus makes, they are quotes from, guess what? From the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 8:3, man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of God. Deuteronomy 6:16, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test. And then Deuteronomy 6:13, you shall worship the Lord your God and serve him only. And I think the fact that Jesus speaks, the very first words he speaks in the Gospels are drawn from the book of Deuteronomy, is reflective of the importance that this book played both in the life of ancient Israel as well as in the life of the early church. In many respects, this book is foundational for what proceeds in the books ahead. Deuteronomy sits at a midpoint between the opening part of Israel's history. You could say their founding stories. And it sits right in the midpoint between the founding story of Israel and its crisis that it will go through in the future as it declines and goes into exile. And so Deuteronomy stands with four books on one side of her, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and Numbers, and then with four books on the other side of her, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. And Joshua through Kings tells about the sorry decline of Israel into sin again and again. And Deuteronomy stands right at the midpoint. Now, the title of this book, Deuteronomy, is a transliteration of its Greek title in the Septuagint. So there was a Hebrew version of the Old Testament, and then there was a Greek translation of that Hebrew Bible. And the Greek translation is called the Septuagint. The title in the Septuagint is Deuteronomy. It's taken from, it's a compound of two Greek words. I know you thought, dude, Deuteronomy. You know, it's taken from dude, Deuteronomy. But actually, that's not the compound. The first word is deuteros, which means second, and namas, which means law, deutera namas. It's a second law. And the title is significant because it tells us something important about what this book is doing. It is giving us a second or a fresh retelling of the Sinai tradition, the Sinai law that was given to Moses at Mount Sinai. The first iteration of the law, of course, is given to the Moses generation. She comes out of Egypt. She goes a little bit through the wilderness, lands at the foot of Sinai, and God delivers his law to his people. He gives them the two tablets with the Ten Commandments and then the extrapolations of what that looks like in a variety of different case law in Israel's life. He gives the instructions for the tabernacle as well as the Levitical priesthood and the sacrificial system and so on and so forth. And so that's Exodus. God gives his law. And then in Deuteronomy, you have a second telling of the law for a new generation, namely the Joshua generation that's going to enter into the land of Canaan. And I think this tells us something significant about God's word, his law of covenant that he gives to his people. There always needs to be a fresh retelling of the law. In fact, if you stop back and you think, because I don't know if you've ever thought about this, but how is it that Deuteronomy came to be? And there is a lot we could say about that. That's a massive question. It's almost foolhardy to open it in this moment. But we could think of it like this. I mean, think about how, say, the Gospel of John came to be. How was it that John got written down? Well, first, it began with events in history, namely the event of Jesus Christ, his life, his healings, his teaching, his table fellowship. He spoke with unsurpassed wisdom. He healed with unparalleled power. He cast out demons with an authority like no one had seen before. And then after going through the rigors of crucifixion, he walked out of the tomb 3 days later. And so the Gospel of John began with the events of Jesus Christ. And then what happened after those events? Well, they were carried to a new generation of people through the lips and through the witness of the eyewitnesses who were there with Jesus, namely his apostles, who went and preached about all that Jesus taught and did and all the significance of it, how it connected to the Old Testament. They did this through their preaching and through their teaching. And through so the events of Jesus were carried orally through the mouths of the eyewitnesses. And then decades later, they were actually written down. So the Gospel of John was written down fairly late in the first century, maybe in the late 70s, early 80s, early 90s, you know, but it's decades after the events. And what does John tell us he's doing? Well, he says, look, he says, I can't tell you everything that Jesus said and did. John was there. He was an eyewitness. And he says, if I tried to write down everything that there is to tell, you know, all of the books in the world, all of the libraries could not contain, you know, the force of Jesus of Nazareth and all that he did. But he says, I've carefully selected some signs, and he chooses seven signs, and he carefully arranges them, and he reshapes them, and he retells them in such a way to make a point and to lead his readers to a place of faith. And so you could say there's three stages in the development of the Gospel of John. Stage one is the events. Stage two is the events are spoken of orally and they're transmitted orally. And then stage three, they're finally written down. And you could think about Deuteronomy going through those same three stages. There's the events of the Exodus, of Sinai, of the wilderness wanderings, of Moses on the plains of Moab, about ready to enter into the promised land or exhort the people as they're entering into the promised land. So those are the events. And then there's the oral traditions that are rooted in Moses, the oral tradition of Moses that is passed on from generation to generation. You have to remember, these are oral, not written cultures. They don't have books, you know, you don't have homes with books in them. You know, this is, you pass on the history and the teachings and the laws and the stories of the nation. All of those things that are so founding are passed on from generation to generation around the fire, through authoritative storytellers and those who were tasked with carrying on the tradition from generation to generation. And then at some point in Israel's history, it gets written down in a book, and then it gets reshaped and refashioned. And there's some question as to when the final form of Deuteronomy was finally written. But I think what we could say is this, is that Deuteronomy, which was, it's framed as a second law, a second hearing of, when we say second, we don't mean it's an additional law. It's not that on the plains of Moab, as Israel is about ready to enter into the promised land, they're given, you know, a second, you know, set of laws. No, they're given a reiteration, a new and fresh hearing of the original law, of the original tradition that then is supposed to inform this new generation in their new context, in their new situation. And this is what the book of Deuteronomy is intended to do, is give a fresh hearing of the Sinai tradition, of Moses, of Israel's stories for this new generation and to shape their life in the land. And you can just imagine generations after this, Israel, it's interesting, one of the things that scholars have pointed out about the book of Deuteronomy, and you have to track with me just for a minute on this because it might feel a little bit convoluted, but Deuteronomy is framed as three sermons given by Moses. So historically, Israel was on the plains of Moab And you can just imagine, you know, hundreds of thousands of Israelites standing, awaiting to enter into the land. And then Moses gets up with his great baritone, you know, I don't know, baritone voice. It's a booming voice, you know, surrounded by these mountains, amplifying his words. And he preaches, as it were, three sermons that are cataloged in the book of Deuteronomy that then give us this fresh hearing of the law. Sermon one is Deuteronomy 1:1 through chapter 4, verse 40. Sermon two is 4:44 through 29:1. Sermon three is 29:2 through 32:47. So it's framed as these three sermons. Now, of course, the middle of the three, sermon number two, is definitely the longest. And what scholars have noted is that this sermon actually is framed using the language and the structure of an Assyrian covenant. Now, check this out. I think this is fascinating, and it's fairly profound. But so Israel, when she was in her land and she had her kings, and her kings, many of them were going south and they were going bad. In the 7th century, they were threatened by the Assyrian Empire to their north. And you could just imagine, I mean, in this time period, you can imagine, but for Americans, it's a little bit difficult to imagine, because Israel at this time is fairly powerless, and she is threatened by this massive military power in the north. I mean, think about Ukraine being threatened by the massive military might of Russia to the north, and Ukraine has a supply of weapons from, you know, NATO. There's NATO that, you know, really wants Ukraine to exist, but Israel at that time had no NATO. They had no surrounding, you know, Western nations that could source them with all kinds of military power to protect them from the powerful threat in the north, which in that time, it was the most globally powerful force. I mean, it was the most powerful military in the world, the Assyrian Empire. They were freaky and they were violent and they would do all kinds of crazy stuff to their enemies that makes, you know, Hitler, by comparison, look tame. I mean, it's hard to make Hitler look tame, but I'm just saying that these ancient nations very oftentimes were incredibly violent and gloried in torturing their enemies and then presenting that to the world, saying, this is what we will do to anyone who defies us. And this is Assyria in the north, and they're threatening Israel. And there were these Assyrian treaties that had a fourfold frame, and that fourfold frame is utilized in the second sermon of Moses. And what many scholars believe is that the words of Moses then are reshaped in this new context, in this new place. You think about a second, another hearing of the Mosaic law for a new generation, calling them to faithfulness to Yahweh, to live all of life under the unique rule of Yahweh that will help them resist in their life together all of the surrounding forces of the world, that they would form, by living underneath God's law, an alternative society to the societies in the world around them. And in this society, they will have a unique way in which they care for neighbors, a unique way in which they structure their economy for justice and fairness, a unique way in which they will divide their land so that everyone has their own plot of land where they have the means of production. And there will be, of course, commands on Israel's worshiping life, on her family life. These families will transmit the faith from generation to generation. And there's all kinds of laws that then govern Israel to be an alternative community in the midst of all the families of the earth. And so here, Assyria to the north threatens Israel, and Israel's kings, their temptation would be to forsake their trust in Yahweh and forsake their unique loyalty to Yahweh and to his way of life, and instead enter into a covenant, into a treaty with foreign, idolatrous, violent kingdoms and imperial powers like Assyria and trust in them instead of trust in God. And so here, I think the middle section, this middle speech, is framed after an Assyrian treaty, some scholars have pointed out, in order to turn Israel away from trusting in the imperial power and turn her towards trusting in the power of Yahweh and submitting themselves to the way of life that God is calling his people to. And so we have a fresh telling, a second iteration of the law that is to be heard afresh in every generation. And so we talked about the Joshua generation about ready to enter into the land. There was the Israelite kingdom, which, by the way, incidentally, Ahaz, King Ahaz, did enter into a covenant treaty with Assyria in the book of Kings. You can read about this, and it's disastrous for the nation. And then a little bit later, Josiah has a reform within the nation, and they have a new sense of passion and commitment to God's law as is given or as is described and as is called for in the book of Deuteronomy. So Deuteronomy is what have we said so far? Well, we've talked about the name. It's a fresh hearing, a second law. We've talked about the historical setting. It is set right on the plains of Moab. It's at the end of Israel's 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. Most of the older generation have died off, and now a new generation is about ready to enter into the land. And so Moses is preaching these three sermons, preparing the people of God for life in the land and calling them to faithfulness to Yahweh when they live their lives in the land. And so it's framed as three sermons. It's Moses's valedictory address and calling them again to faithfulness. And it is a carefully, highly selective retelling of their history. And so this is what and it stands as this important middle point between Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and the four books that follow: Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings. It looks back on their foundations. It looks ahead to a future crisis and the decline of the nation. And one more point, kind of a theological point about what Deuteronomy is doing. And I think this is pretty interesting, and I think it's pretty cool. And hopefully you also will think it's kind of cool and interesting. But, you know, the way a podcast works, you can't talk back to me. So I just have to trust that you're listening in and you're enjoying this, and you're like, yes, Deuteronomy. And so we're going to, by the way, get into the meat of Deuteronomy in episodes ahead. But this, again, is by way of introduction. So where we pick up Deuteronomy in the flow of the Pentateuch, that's the first five books of Moses, we essentially move from creation to the borders of the Jordan. And as we move from creation to the Jordan, what are we doing? Well, we're moving from the opening chapters of Genesis, where God creates all this beautiful land, and then God plants a garden, and God puts his people to dwell in this garden. And so God originally creates the human creatures, not just for himself, though he does that. We are meant to live for God underneath the rule of God. And we are not only created for vocation, be fruitful and multiply, fill the earth and rule over it. And we're not only created for relationship, it's not good for the human to be alone, but in the beginning, the humans were created to inhabit this space, the Garden of Eden, a special land. And in the text, it's flowing with these rivers, and there are these precious stones of onyx and gold, and there's these jewels, and it's this beautiful land that the human creatures are intended to dwell in. The land is called Eden, which means delight or joy. And so it's this land of delight and joy. But what happens in Genesis? Well, They turn their back on God and they get sent into exile and they go outside of the land. And the next human creatures we meet, Cain and Abel, well, there's violence, there's murder outside the garden. And then Abel is sent wandering east of Eden. And so Abel, or Cain, I'm sorry, Cain killed Abel. So Abel's not wandering anyway. But Cain is now wandering, and Cain is wandering east of Eden in exile. And then when we meet Abraham, what is the promise given to Abraham? The promise is given to Abraham that God is going to make him into a great nation. Even as in Genesis 1, God said to be fruitful and multiply. God's intention was always to create a vibrant, flourishing human community who would live in relationship with himself, under his rule, enrich community together, inhabiting the land of delight, the Garden of Eden, doing great work and vocation there, cultivating the land and living well in the land. This was God's intention. And so God's intention seems to be lost or foiled or frustrated because God's people are now in exile and they are wanderers from the land and there is fractures and there's violence and outside of Eden, life is harsh and hard. And then God comes to Abraham and he makes him a promise. He says, I'm going to make you into a great nation. I'm going to bless you, make your name great. You're going to have as many descendants as there are sand on the seashore and stars in the sky. This is my plan for you. And then he says, and I'm going to bring you into a land, a good land that will be flowing with milk and honey. And in this land, God's people will once again live under his law and his rule. As it were, Canaan is pictured as being something kind of a second Eden. The human creatures are alienated from God's place. They are in exile. And to Abraham, God says, I'm going to bring you back in the land. I'm going to bring you back home again. You're going to be in the land of Canaan. And now what do we get when we get to Deuteronomy? Well, we've moved from creation to exile from the land. And now God has brought his people. Now they're on the very borders of entering back into a land flowing with milk and honey. And this reveals something of God's intention for his human creatures. God's intention is ultimately to bring his people into his own place, to take them out of exile and out of alienation and bring us home again into a land that is beautiful and ripe with God's presence and flooded with God's goodness, where we can live together in community and in harmony and in wholeness and in shalom and underneath God's good rule. And in essence, as Israel is on the verge of entering into the land of promise, Moses is saying, look, when you go into the land, you are God's covenant people. Live underneath his good law, and you will experience God's goodness in this new land. But of course, this isn't what happens. They go into the land, and we'll get there when we get to Joshua, Judges, Samuel, and Kings. I mean, this is sort of the story. It's the story of Israel taking possession of the land. And like Israel, or like Adam and Eve in Eden, Israel ultimately lands in the garden, or in the city of Canaan, or in the land of Canaan, and they have the city of God built with the temple of God, and God's presence dwells, and they have God's king in their land. But then Israel is unfaithful to their law, and ultimately they get sent out, put out in exile from the land. And it's Eden happening all over again. And they lose possession of their land as promised actually in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy says, look, you're going to go into the land and you're going to be unfaithful and you're going to be kicked out of the land again. But it doesn't diminish the fact that God's plan from the beginning is always for his people to dwell safely in God's place. And, you know, when you get to the New Testament, we have a new and a better Joshua who leads his people into a new and better land of promise, namely Jesus. Jesus becomes actually the true and better Moses as well. And you remember he gives his people in the Sermon on the Mount, just like Moses went up on Mount Sinai and delivered his to God's people the law, Jesus goes up on the mountains and he delivers to his people his authoritative interpretation of Moses in the Sermon on the Mount. And this is to be the law of God's people, a law that goes well beyond the original commands of Moses. This is a law that amplifies it and it deepens it and it enriches what it looks like to be God's people living underneath God's law. And ultimately, Jesus is there to bring us into the promised land. And you get to the end of the Bible in Revelation, the very last chapters, and what do you see? Well, our paradise that was lost in Genesis 1 and 2 is regained. And there is an image of a new garden, only this is a city garden, or it's a temple garden city, because the presence of God dwells in the midst of it. And God, ultimately, his intention is to bring his people not just to the borders of the promised land, but actually bring us into a new redeemed creation where we live underneath God's rule, living afresh underneath God's law. And so when we get back into the went a little bit far afield from Deuteronomy, but I think it's important to kind of think about this text theologically and where it stands within the unfolding story of the people of God. So I hope that this introduction has given you some little insight into Deuteronomy, its structure, its intention, and its role that it would continue to play in the life of ancient Israel, and then also in the life of Jesus and in the church, and how it gives us a faint glimmer into what God's ultimate purpose is, which is to bring his people into God's new creation, the new land, the new Canaan, as it were, to be God's faithful covenant people living underneath his law. And when we get back together next time, we will be diving into some of the significant texts in the book of Deuteronomy.
Praise Father, Son,